It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, learn about how at-home DNA tests are being used by police to track down criminals and talk about some ethical questions that raises. Now, it's been a busy week for news on the Russia investigation. First, a legal filing showed Paul Manafort was sharing Trump polling data with Russian contacts in 2016. The Washington Post reported on the lengths President Trump has gone to conceal what he's talked about with Russian President Vladimir Putin, reportedly even keeping the details from top administration officials. And a story in the New York Times says the FBI opened a counterintelligence investigation into the president last year. That investigation was reportedly to determine whether or not the president was working on behalf of Russia, wittingly or unwittingly. Here's President Trump responding to that last story this morning at the White House.
I never worked for Russia. And you know that answer better than anybody. I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question, because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. Lowell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, a lot going on over the last week. Let's start with this New York Times report. How big a deal is it that the FBI apparently opened this investigation into whether President Trump had intentionally or unintentionally fired James Comey on behalf of Russia?
Well, this is a very important story in a lot of ways. I think it's in some ways to people perhaps not a complete surprise that they did this, but it's still, I think, a quite interesting and important development, because it acknowledges, really in some ways for the first time, that the president himself was a target of an investigation, in this case a counterintelligence investigation. And while it's, you know, it does not mean there will be detailed evidence that there was direct involvement in a conspiracy by President Trump against the United States, and the FBI was certainly investigating a range of options, including this was sort of just innocent naivete on his part. But the other extreme, for them to be considering the idea that he was taking, in fact, direction from and acting in the interests of Russia, even if it meant going against U.S. interests, I mean, that's an incredibly important and certainly quite unprecedented story.
Benjamin Wittes on the Lawfare blog wrote that this might connect a couple things that we hadn't thought were connected before. We used to think there was a Russia probe and then there was an obstruction of justice probe, and maybe that the firing of James Comey could be viewed as an obstruction of justice. This in some ways connects the dots between their foreign intelligence probe and their criminal probe here in the United States.
I think that was a very interesting point by Ben Wittes. I actually saw him talking about this as well after that post. And I think it is true that the collusion conspiracy stream that would include Trump or Trump advisors, and the obstruction of justice stream in terms of investigating the president or other high-ranking officials, have also, I mean, been talked about quite a bit as separate streams. And in fact, there's a really good reason now, I think, to think that, in fact, the obstruction of justice might have been part of an ongoing conspiracy, including well after President Trump took office. And I found this very interesting. I found it quite compelling. I would go one step further and link it also to something we've talked about, which is the third stream that we sometimes don't think about as an ongoing third stream is the potential to look at financial crimes that are uncovered during the investigation. And I think when we start to ask some of the questions about why we see the things that may be happening in the areas of obstruction of justice or possible collusion, I think that financial crimes question is a kind of third piece that may also be intertwined with the other two.
Now, one tricky thing in talking about the Mueller probe is, for the most part, it seems like we don't know what Mueller and his team are doing until they issue an indictment. There's not a lot of leaking going on. So with this early, this pre-Mueller investigation, looking at the president, that may be ongoing with Robert Mueller. It may have nothing to do with what he's doing right now. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so, although my understanding is that Mueller would have been brought into this investigation or been brought up to speed on it once he took the position of special counsel. So I believe he would have been in the loop. We don't know, again, whether this has already been wrapped up and there's findings already about it one way or the other. The thing I would say is rule number one in this story is always that Mueller knew all this months ago. And so when we're surprised by new things, we have to realize this is something that he knew about and had been working on for a long time now. And I think in this case, again, he would have been brought in quite early on and really was very aware of what was going on. And therefore, again, we won't probably find out things, as you said, unless there's an indictment, which in this case, again, would be unusual because we're really talking, again, about a counterintelligence investigation, not a criminal investigation. But where we would get details about this, if Mueller is going to provide them, would be in his final report.
Now, the president this morning said he had not worked with the Russians. He said in an interview over the weekend he found questions about this insulting. The president's narrative has been, and some of his team, that there have been politically motivated investigations led by partisan agents, administrators within the FBI. With this new information, this report of this earlier FBI investigation, what do you make of the president's case about the FBI?
Well, and we're still seeing this take on the FBI today all over sort of things online about this is actually, for some in the country, further proof of this deep state targeting of President Trump. I think the people who are involved in this and the people who, again, would have been involved as it moved to the Mueller team, these are really serious people, and they take very seriously this question. All the way from the extreme of this was innocent and not a problem to, you know, there were things going on here that really did look like President Trump was taking actions that certainly Russia was very happy about and trying to connect dots as to why that would be. So, again, I don't accept the idea this is a politically motivated investigation. Many of the people who are key players in this investigation have now been appointed by the Trump administration. They were not leftovers at all at this point from, you know, the Obama administration. So I think that claim is really getting kind of increasingly on thin ice over the time that we've moved forward.
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, looking at some of the latest news in Russia probe-related developments. Lowell, we saw last week, because of a poorly redacted legal document from Paul Manafort's team, apparently he's accused of supplying polling information, including some private Trump campaign polling information, to Russian contacts while Paul Manafort was campaign manager. How big a deal is that story?
Well, again, I think it's an interesting story, and I think it got some attention because it raises interesting kind of why was this going on questions. I am actually less concerned about this from a question of whether it was legal or not for Manafort to do this. I think it probably was legal. I think one of the few things Rudy Giuliani has gotten right in the last few months is that Manafort shouldn't have done this, but it probably, you know, isn't illegal. But I will say that the question of why he was sharing these data is the troubling part for me and for a lot of people. I think it, you know, it could be part of this idea of kind of keeping people like Kalimnik in the loop about the campaign. He owed Oleg Deripaska money and wanted that debt forgiven, and Kalimnik and Deripaska know each other well. And, I mean, there could have been some parts of this that, again, were not quite as deep of a kind of conspiracy-type collusion as some are saying. But it also could have been that, and it really boils down to, again, why the data were given and how they were used. So if these data were used by Russia, for example, to target particular states in the United States, and we know that Russia was much more aggressive in its online attacks in the United States on certain states, and that includes Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and others that, again, proved to be very important in the final outcome. So if those data were used to help the Russians and work with the Russians to formulate an action against the U.S. election, that certainly would be an incredibly important story at that point.
Also out there, a Washington Post story about President Trump concealing apparently details of conversations between himself and President Putin from Russia. This is something that, you know, we in the public don't generally get to read transcripts, but it sounds like concealing information about these meetings, interpreters' notes, that kind of thing, even from some of his closest staff. Nothing illegal here, I don't think, but a bit unusual.
Definitely unusual, and I think, again, what's unusual in the first place was the number of these one-on-one meetings where there weren't other people in the room besides translators. Again, that's not something we tend to see. The president would want people in the room with foreign policy expertise, with knowledge of the country that he is speaking with, that country's leader at the time. So I think the meetings in the first place are a concern. And certainly there was some effort to keep the information from advisors in his own administration about what was discussed. And as somebody who works in the region, the person I was really concerned to hear about was Fiona Hill, who's the main White House advisor on Russia and well-respected, I think, in the Russian studies community, that she specifically asked the interpreter to talk to her about what had gone on in the meeting, and the person refused to do that because they had been told not to talk to her about it. That's, again, a really big concern because it means if the chief advisor on Russia is out of the loop on conversations like this, we're just not ready to formulate responses, for example, to claims that Russia might make about what was said. And that's one of the concerns people have, is without a record of what was said, we are certainly vulnerable to Russia making statements about things that the president, for example, had promised without others in the room to you know, in fact, challenge that claim by Russia.
Stepping back a bit, one big picture item that's changed in the last month is there's a Democratic majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Does that change how the investigation goes? Does this add new wrinkles?
I think the things that have gone on in the last couple of weeks have given even more of a sense of urgency to Democrats who will now control this process in the House to hold hearings and to issue subpoenas that they now have the power to do. One of the things the Republicans had done in the past was to change this so that only the chair of the committee in the House needed to support issuing a subpoena for bringing somebody to testify, and that was convenient when they controlled the House. It's now going to be very inconvenient for the White House because the Democrats will control that subpoena power, and I think we can expect a lot of investigations, both Russia-related, but I think a lot of other investigations as well, and hearings on just basic things about government agencies and things where there was not a lot of oversight on the legislative side in the last 2 years.
Finally, a new presidential campaign is kicking off now. Has anything changed in the United States that would make it harder for, say, Russia to interfere with our elections again?
Well, that's the really important question looking ahead, and it's something I think we still don't have a great answer on. I think we were all very concerned about 2018, that there had not seemed to have been enough preparation, but I think for the most part, people feel like to the extent that there were some things going on in 2018. It was a bit less than 2016. So we may be in better shape. But again, one of the things about a country like Russia is they always probe and target and do things and then learn and try different things down the road. So we also can't assume because we had one election that went a little better or that we know what they did in 2016 that means we're ready for 2020. They are likely working on different things that they would have not tried earlier, but will now try in future elections.
Lowell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. He was with us to talk about some of the latest developments in the Trump-Russia probe, including, among other things, news that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation into President Trump last year. Coming up, we'll get an update on some of the latest science news, including how bees might shine the light on human stem cell research. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of people over the age of 55 want or need a job, but our guess is they're having a hard time finding one that lets them save for retirement, even in the midst of an economic recovery. Now it's time for our monthly check-in on some of the most interesting science news. At-home genetic testing has grown in popularity over the years as people want to learn more about their history, but its high-profile use by police in California to catch the alleged Golden State Killer has some people asking how much access law enforcement has to our genetic information. Anna Groves is an assistant editor for Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this genetic testing and the Golden State Killer story. This was big in the news for a while. So these home genetic testing kits help police find a suspect. Is that right?
Right. So police were able to take DNA evidence from this unsolved serial killer case and match it to some of these repositories of these at-home DNA kits, and they've found the killer that way.
And this isn't the only time they've done this, right? It may be that police will use this data from these home genetic testing kits to try to solve other unsolved crimes.
Yeah, I think they're going to be using it more and more. Just in the news today, I saw a man also in California was arrested last Thursday on some cold case rape cases. They used the DNA data in the exact same way as with the Golden State Killer. And they were actually able to narrow down their suspects to both this man, Kevin Conther, and his twin brother, of course, because identical twins have the same DNA. And it wasn't until taking them both into custody that they were able to narrow it down to Kevin.
And as you were touching on, this is a little weird because, you know, it doesn't have to be the person in question who had gotten one of these home testing kits. It could be people related to them, and that can be used to narrow it down to a particular group of people or individual in this case.
Right, because people share so much DNA with their close relatives. So the closer you are to somebody, relative-wise, the more DNA you have in common.
And this raises some ethical concerns. This was in a recent issue of Discover magazine where people are thinking, okay, this is between me and the testing company, and that's it. It's not clear what's going to happen with our genetic data when it's collected.
Right. The more these things are in the news, the more people are calling for more transparency. And, of course, these companies will say that this sort of information was always in their privacy policy or their terms of use. But I think this is making people more and more aware of like how their genetic data is actually going to be used and shared with authorities or whoever else.
So we'll be watching to see how that develops. I want to check out a couple stories now that you've written about on your blog at Discover Magazine. Now, people might have seen this in stores, Royal Jelly Supplements. It's this, well, what is Royal Jelly, first of all, before we dig into the story?
Yeah, so royal jelly is something that honeybees make. So this is a substance that is made in the hive, and it's what they apply to a bee larva to turn it into a queen bee. So normally when all the bee larvae are born, they're all genetically the same. There's nothing special about the queen bee. But then when they pick out one of the larvae, they feed it this substance, and that's what makes a queen.
And it turns out that royal jelly does something for mammal stem cells, mice, and, and maybe for humans. What the heck?
Yeah, this is really wild. So researchers at Stanford were curious in royal jelly because it has been sort of advertised for many years as like a supplement for humans to take. So they were like, well, what the heck? Why is there this connection for humans? Is this all just crackpot claims? But they thought, well, if anything, it's probably going to have an effect on stem cells because of what they knew about how it worked in the beehive. So they tested it out on some embryonic stem cells from mice to see what it would do. And amazingly, it had this crazy effect on them where it kept the stem cells as stem cells. So I got to explain this for a second. So it's normally a stem cell is just sort of a base cell that could turn into any number of types of cell in the body. So like a stem cell might turn into a bone cell or a muscle cell or anything in the body. But to have this chemical that can keep it as a stem cell, that means that as the cells are dividing and multiplying, it means you get more and more stem cells, which is a really big deal, even just from a scientific perspective. So they're thinking now that the reason why royal jelly has an impact on people could be because it has this interaction with the stem cells. Now, did that make any sense?
Yeah, and it's still a little mysterious. Like, we shouldn't all go out popping royal jelly pills because it's not clear what it does, and it's expensive. But the weird thing to me you wrote about is it all comes down to this one protein. It's in the bee, in the royal jelly from the bees, and it happens to fit this lock. It's like a key and a lock in stem cells. What?
Yeah, so the reason why the bee compound from the royal jelly, it's called royal actin, the reason why that has any effect on the mouse cells or human cells at all is because it has the exact same shape as a protein that's in mammals. So not only did the researchers find this crazy effect on stem cells, but then they went and used the shape of the bee protein to go find the right human protein analog. So they essentially discovered a new protein in humans that's sort of a mirror image of the royal jelly protein.
All right, I want to check out one more story in the health world before we let you go. The irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease. A lot of people are diagnosed with these. To an extent, they're sort of shrug, you feel bad, and we're not entirely clear why diagnosis a lot of the time. Yeah. There's some research looking at the bacteria in our guts to try to identify these, maybe to help cure them. What are we finding out?
Yeah, so this group out of the Netherlands did this really cool research sequencing the gut microbiome. So they identified all sorts of different bacteria that live in the guts of healthy people and people with IBS and people with IBD. And they wanted to see how they were the same and how they were different. And they found not only significant differences between what bacteria were living in the guts of people with IBS and IBD compared to healthy people, but also there are enough differences between the IBS patients and the IBD patients that they're hopeful that they can use this technology for a diagnosis in the future.
Right. So you could maybe diagnose people without a colonoscopy, which sounds like a great development.
Yes. Everyone is thrilled.
Yeah. And then a question that pops to my mind is, all right, do people with IBS or IBD have different bacteria because those bacteria are causing their problems? Or is this like a symptom? Is this a consequence of some underlying cause that's causing IBD or IBS? Do we know that?
That's the million-dollar question. We do not know that yet, but this is a huge step in finding that out.
And briefly, how does one do a massive census of people's gut biomes?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Maybe I'm not, but it takes a lot of poop. Am I allowed to say poop on
you
the air?
You can say this, yes, especially for a scientific purpose.
So, yes, it was very scientific. So they had this big database in the Netherlands of like thousands of people that they had a bunch of medical information on already. So they already knew who had IBS, who had IBD, and so on. So they asked all of those people to give them fecal samples, which essentially they had to collect at home. I'll let you use your imagination to think of how they did that. But then they had to keep the samples in their freezers, their home freezers, because the samples couldn't be sitting out at room temperature or it would mess up the bacterial communities because some would grow and things like that. So then the researchers had to just drive around the Netherlands picking up people's frozen poop samples.
The glories of scientific research. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Groves, assistant editor at Discover Magazine, bringing us up to date on some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. Coming up, we'll find out why low unemployment and an economic recovery aren't adding up to good news for older workers. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the NFL playoffs are in high gear, but the Packers are not in them. We'll look at the Packers' choice as a new head coach and what it could mean for the future. First, overall unemployment rates are low in the United States after 8 years of steady recovery from the Great Recession. But that good news hasn't helped everyone. A large number of workers over 55 are having a hard time finding work, and when they do find jobs, they're often paid less than in their previous jobs. And in many cases, those careers don't include health care and other benefits. That's putting the dream of a comfortable retirement way out of reach for millions of older Americans. Ruth Simon is a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. She reported on this issue under the headline, "Just Unbearable, Booming Job Market Can't Fill the Retirement Shortfall." Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to talk to you, Rob.
Well, you write in your piece that the official unemployment rate for older workers is about 3%, which doesn't sound bad, but that number doesn't tell us the whole story. What are you seeing out there behind that number for older workers?
Behind that number, we're seeing that it's very hard if you're an older worker and you need to find a job to get a job, and particularly to get a job that pays well. So we have nearly 8 million older Americans who are out of work, or they're stuck in low-quality jobs that don't offer them much chance of preparing for retirement. This includes people who have jobs that don't provide health care or other basic benefits, typically don't pay very well. There are also more than 2 million Americans who are out of work or work part-time because they can't find a full-time job, or have stopped looking because they don't think anyone will hire them.
We'll dig into those stories a little more in just a bit. But even before that, we hear numbers over time that say, hey, Americans of whatever age aren't prepared. They haven't been able to save enough for retirement. That's what a lot of people, I imagine, are coming into this situation in, right? Already, they're maybe a little behind when it comes to saving for retirement, even without this job problem.
And this story was part of a series of stories we've done about people not being prepared for retirement. And if you're not prepared, one of the best things you can do is work a little bit longer. And that's why what's happening to these workers is so important. And it's also, it was very surprising to me when I started doing my reporting. I thought, gee, we have a really tight job market. There must be all these opportunities for older workers. But that wasn't the case.
Do we know why it's harder for these older workers? Maybe they've been let go from an older job or downsized or whatever. Why it's hard for them in particular to find jobs maybe comparable to the career they've had all along?
I think there are a bunch of different reasons that are at play. There's some evidence of age discrimination. We looked at some studies that have sent out resumes with different ages, and older workers, particularly older women, got fewer responses when it came to interviews. Many companies have also long directed their recruiting efforts at young people coming out of college. Some have even created apprenticeship programs. I talked to one employer who said, I'm not sure how we reach these older workers. Sometimes older workers don't have the right skills, or they're not living in the right places. And the other thing we have now are these automated systems that are used to screen employees, and they might say, we're looking for this specific skill, and don't realize, well, maybe you don't know this computer language, but you've shown you can learn three others, so you can probably learn this one quickly, or you don't fit that right requirement, or you don't really understand how looking for a job works today.
Right. You write that some employers are using maybe a social media outlet or some kind of online job search tool that might make a job listing invisible to people beyond a certain age.
They may be looking for someone with 3 to 5 years of experience. They may be looking for someone with knowledge of just a very narrow skill. They're looking for that perfect employee rather than someone who may have skills that are related but aren't exactly the right fit. And I think there's also sometimes employers don't value that experience an older worker might bring, and they're worried that an older worker may cost too much or have higher health care costs.
Talking to Ruth Simon, senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal, on her reporting on older workers in today's workplace. Even though there's low overall unemployment, people over, say, 55 having a hard time finding jobs that allow them to save for retirement. And Ruth, you talked to a lot of workers, and I understand you've heard from a lot of people since the piece came out. Can you share some of the stories people have told you about how this is hurting their retirement efforts?
Well, first let me talk a little bit about the response that I got after the story came out. And I don't want to, we name specific people who I'm happy to talk about in the story, but after I got a number of notes from people saying, thank you so much for writing about this. This is just my situation. Somebody wrote to me saying he had been very depressed because he thought it was a reflection of himself until he saw my story and then understood there were these bigger issues. I had people write to me and say, my relative has had this situation, my brother, my friend, or I've been in a group with a lot of job seekers. And guess what? Most of them are in their late 40s, their 50s, their 60s, and they're in the same boat. But let me tell you a little bit about some of the people that I talked to.
Sure.
One of the women I talked to, her name is Jill Short. She had an MBA. She worked for the federal government. She worked for a local utility. She worked for a technology subcontractor, but she had to take some time off for foot surgery, which happened by her bad luck to be right around the financial crisis. It was hard for her to reenter the job market. She got a job. Then she lost it in a restructuring, and she had a temporary position when I talked to her that ended in the middle of December. She was getting food stamps. She had a bunch of credit card debt. She had loans from friends. And you wouldn't think in this job market it would be so hard for someone like her to get a job. I talked to another woman who had two part-time jobs, and she liked both of the part-time jobs a lot, but they didn't pay her enough that she could have her own apartment in a neighborhood where she would be safe. So she was renting a room from a couple who had been very nice to her, and when she was on the verge of homelessness, had offered to take in her dog.
And talk about how this is changing people's retirement plans. You quote somebody saying something like, yeah, we have this vision of, you know, you're 60, you're 65, you retire, you play golf for 5 years, and then you die. This is not the situation people are staring at now.
People are living longer. And so this old, you retire at 60, 62, 65, many people need to work longer. Many people want to work longer. Many people are capable of working longer. But people are living longer, which means they need more retirement savings. Often we have situations, and I didn't get into it in my story, but my colleagues have, where people have older parents they need to take care of. They have children that they might have had late in life or who are adults who still need some kind of financial support. So this idea that we're all going to be ready to retire, you know, in our early 60s, it's just not the case anymore. But the work world hasn't adjusted to that.
You write that some community organizations around the country are trying to tackle this to try to help pair up older workers with employers. What kind of efforts are you seeing?
So one of the examples that I looked at is Michigan AARP has been trying to partner with local groups to do these job fairs for older workers. They did one with the Southeast Michigan Community Alliance. They held their first job fair this spring, and what they had was the job seekers' qualifications were reviewed ahead of the fair to make sure they had the needed skills. More than 30 of them received offers, but there were also people who were looking for a kind of skilled position that was not available. So when they go back and do it again, they're going to try to do a different kind of screening for the employers. I think often what happens is employers are looking for these older workers to do jobs like being a greeter that involves standing on your feet a lot. And there are people who want those. That's a nice job for some people, but others who are looking for more skilled positions. But that's one effort that we saw.
We're talking to Ruth Simon from the Wall Street Journal. She's reported on the millions of older Americans who are unemployed or underemployed, and in many cases seeing their retirement savings, if any, evaporate. Are we talking about you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. If you're 50, 55 or older, and on the job market, what are you seeing? What are you running into? Have you gotten a job lately? Does it pay enough to save for retirement? Or has a change in your employment situation derailed your plans? If this isn't your story, is there somebody in your family going through this? Or if you're an employer, what are you seeing? Are you looking to hire older workers yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about older workers facing tough times in the workplace, even in the midst of low unemployment. Ruth Simon is with us from the Wall Street Journal, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you 55 or older trying to find work? How's it going for you? Are you an employer? Are you looking to hire older workers if you knew where to find them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to our callers. James is with us in Green Bay. James, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, James?
Well, basically, what I've seen out there in the workforce is a lot of employers are still looking for a master's or a bachelor's degree, and some older workers don't have that. Maybe they have all the life skills or all the skills to actually do the job, but they just don't have that certificate.
James, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Ruth, I imagine this could be a problem in, say, a post-industrial manufacturing community where maybe people have that life experience. They got a job with a high school degree. If they need that BA or MA now, it's maybe hard to get that later in life.
And I'll say I talked to a group that works with technology workers in Silicon Valley, and they have a lot of unemployed job seekers who are older. And one of the things they do is they encourage these job seekers to go back and get some kind of certificate. So maybe you can't get your entire degree, or maybe you have your degree, but you go back and get a certificate that shows that you have picked up another skill that is relevant. It's a way of both showing that you have a skill, learning a new skill, and showing something new to your potential employer.
James, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Deb now in Madison. Deb, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Deb?
Well, I have been unemployed for more than a little over a year. I have applied for over 100 jobs. I'm 62 years old. I have a PhD. I am an excellent facilitator, trainer, communication leader kind of person, and I have only been able to even apply for a handful of those jobs. I know lots of other people in my age group with the same situation. We were in an unemployment support group here in Madison, still all unemployed. Very frustrating to hear about this unprecedented low unemployment rate when there's all this talent sitting here untapped.
Deb, thank you so much for calling in. Good luck to you and your support group in finding work. Ruth, this Deb is telling a story you've heard. You wrote about people who kept huge, folders and binders full of the jobs they applied for and didn't get.
And it's very, very frustrating, and it's hard to not take it personally, though I hope you don't take it personally. Some of the people I've talked to have done things to try to, what I call, de-age their resume, focusing on their most recent years of experience. I think always, to the degree that you can do networking, whether it's through LinkedIn or other sources, that's always helpful. But you're not alone. This story certainly resonates with what I was hearing in my reporting.
Deb, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your experience. Lynette joins us next in Madison. Lynette, hi.
Hi. I am calling in because I'm 50 years old, and I've been unemployed since April. On unemployment right now, and that runs out the end of January. And I have an associate's degree, worked as an art director and graphic designer for over 21 years, and was downsized in the spring. And I'm really struggling. I am de-aging my resume. I have a good friend who works in HR, and she's been trying to help me out to make it look better. But then when I get the face-to-face, I mean, you can't hide the wrinkles. And, so now I'm looking at new skills, to try to get certified in a different area and just change my career. I feel like that's the only option that I have at this point in time. I'm very frustrated when I'm hearing this low unemployment rate, and I think I'm going to seek out Deb's support group, too, when I get off the phone.
All right, Lynette, thank you so much for sharing that. Lynette feeling like, hey, she can maybe get in the door face-to-face. They can tell she's older. Do we have, Ruth, a pin on how big the actual age discrimination problem is, just people discriminating flat out against older workers?
It's always hard to exactly prove, age discrimination. But we do know, I had talked to a professor who did this study where he sent out resumes, and they were for folks with they were fictional resumes for job seekers who were 30, 50, and 65, and callback rates declined by age, and that was especially true for female applicants. I also talked to some people who said, I did really well in the first part of the process, and then they saw me, they came in the room and they saw me for the interview and their face dropped. I know the one other thing I'll say is one of the gentlemen I interviewed, he dyed his hair just to make him look a little bit younger.
Thanks, and good luck to you as well, Lynette. We are talking to Ruth Simon from the Wall Street Journal, looking at the challenges facing older workers. Even in a supposedly tight job market, a lot of older workers having a hard time finding jobs, having a hard time finding jobs that pay well enough to save for retirement. Joe joins us now in Neenah. Hi, Joe. What's your story?
Well, hi. I got 35 years experience. I'm age 67. I gave up a year ago and retired. I have retirement savings. But there's no doubt, there's discrimination out there. When you got a question on the application that says, what year did you graduate, you can't hide that. And I don't try to hide myself, but what I try to point out is I could coach and mentor other people. I've been successful in many different jobs, but they don't seem to respond to that, and I don't get any kind of feeling that they're looking for people who are quality workers.
So, Joe, you are retired but looking to work some part-time, it sounds like?
Yeah, exactly. I could go work part-time. I could work full-time. I didn't want to retire. I just had to because I got the feeling that I was being pushed out.
I gotcha.
That I lost in a restructuring, and after that I couldn't recover.
All right, Joe, good luck to you as well. Best wishes to everybody who's having this trouble. Ruth, flipping this around, are we missing out on this great talent pool of people like Joe and our other callers today?
I think we are, and I just want to say one thing about Joe's situation before I get to that, which is the numbers that I have may even understate what's going on because there are people who just gave up and stopped looking, and because they haven't looked in the past year aren't even counted as a discouraged worker. And I think companies are losing the benefit of these older workers. I interviewed a company called Chroma Technologies and that had won an award for hiring older workers and doing things for their older employees. And the CEO sort of said, you know, it's not that we go out to do that, it's that we value experience, and that older workers, they had hired somebody for a very important role who was very experienced, and he felt incredibly fortunate to be able to have this person because of the skills they could bring. And I think employers need to think about older workers as mentors. I mean, people say, despite the some of the stereotypes against older workers, they have a lot of knowledge, they have great work skills, they show up, you know, and I think employers really are missing out.
Joe, thanks for the call. Matt joins us now in Alloway. Matt, hello.
One of the things that I've been finding is that I look at jobs, and there are two things that I noticed, and that is, you know, one of them is that there doesn't seem to be as many sort of middle-class jobs. There is this spread of jobs that's like I qualify there for like $9 or $10 an hour. I'm an alternative teacher, and I used to have a lot of jobs in state and federal and nonprofit, so now I'm subbing. But the other thing that I notice is that those that are middle-income, usually the first three words that they'll say is they want somebody who's vibrant and energetic and enthusiastic. And as an older worker, I'm patient, I'm on time, I'm reliable. I don't have the vim and vigor that I used to have when I was really young, but to me, those three words say that they want somebody young.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Ruth, code words there, vigorous and vibrant?
I think those are code words, but I think that there are plenty of people in their 50s and 60s who would consider themselves vigorous and vibrant, and maybe they can't run as fast, but they run really well.
Thanks a lot for that call. Matt, in our last few moments, Ruth, we've had a lot of calls. You've had a lot of response to this. Do you get a sense that maybe there's going to be a change here, that people are starting to pay attention to older workers and try to bring them back into the job pool?
I think we're just starting to. The thing that surprised me in my reporting was that we weren't further along than we are. I know that I have talked to some companies and some folks who are trying to do this, who are just starting their first efforts, but it is much slower than I would have thought. One of the companies I talked to had said that for the first time they are opening up a position, some positions for people who don't have the skills, and they're hoping folks at all ages will apply.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Ruth Simon, senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal, talking about her reporting on older workers having a hard time finding jobs, even in the midst of low national unemployment. Social media fame is a popularity contest, sure, but it can tell us something about the culture we live in. That's why a lot of people are watching the new record holder with the most likes on the site Instagram. The previous number one was an Instagram birth announcement by Kylie Jenner. That's one of the Jenner Kardashian media juggernaut. That post had about 18 million likes. That's pretty good. But there's a new number one with over 30 million likes and counting. Is it a celebrity? A politician? A comical teenager doing something funny? No, it's egg. Yes, it's just a picture of an egg. Here's the caption, world record egg. Let's set a world record together and get the most liked post on Instagram, beating the current world record held by Kylie Jenner, 18 million. We got this. When I checked a little while ago, that post was closing in on 33.5 million likes, and every time you refresh, it was going up by another 100 or 200 every few seconds. I, for one, welcome our new egg overlord. I love when absurd things happen for no apparent reason on the internet. I say, go, egg, go. I don't think anybody's going to top this one. I just don't think so. We don't have an Instagram account on Central Time, so we're out of the running. Maybe someday. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.